It's time for the fastest 15 minutes in the news. This is Dory's Fastest 15.
David Bowe's in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Time for the Fastest 15. We start with 30 small earthquakes near Mount Hood since Monday. Now that Washington State, we had our own little rumble. They seem to be happening across the West Coast. We had some big ones in the Los Angeles area, over 30 small quakes near Mount Hood since Monday. And then we had our own epicenter out toward New York. The U.S. Geological Survey said the earthquake swarm started on Monday, and that as of 11 a.m. Tuesday, more than 30 had occurred. The quakes, though, were too small to be felt and were about 2 to 3 miles deep, happened about 5 miles south of Mount Hood. So what I like about that is it just, even though I'm not a geologist and, you know, the science of it is probably totally unrelated, but whenever something like that happens and you see an earthquake in Los Angeles, then in the Oregon area, and then up here in Washington State, you see that big lineup and you think of, you know, the Ring of Fire, so to speak, and you start wondering, is it the big one? And you start picturing, you know, Hollywood disaster films, which is always fun until something bad actually happens, and then it's just horrible.
You're making me nervous. I'm going to be in L.A. this weekend.
Well, right in the middle
of a news story.
You should always be nervous going to Los Angeles. That's the way it is, but not necessarily due to the earthquakes here. Another thing to make you nervous, a toxic plant that can cause blindness and third-degree burns has been spotted in Clark County. I didn't even know that was possible from this stuff. Clark County officials are warning people that this toxic plant, giant hogweed, was spotted near Salmon Creek. It can grow up to 20 feet tall. So if you think your dandelion problem is big, imagine having a noxious weed that gets 20 feet tall. The leaves can span more than 3 feet, and it can cause blindness and third-degree burns. get the Roundup ready and go spray that stuff down. Apparently, the seeds then float down the river, float downstream of Salmon Creek, so there's fears that it could spread. The county's working on eradicating it before it gets bigger. And I have to say, it just looks like kind of a pretty flower.
Yeah, it doesn't look like the nightmarish plant you'd think. Did you ever watch that VeggieTales episode about the rumor weed? I remember seeing that as a kid.
You know what? I'm flattered that you think I'm that young, but VeggieTales were a little bit after my time.
You've got kids, though.
You know? They're a little young for TV, but I haven't seen the VeggieTales show.
It's this weed that grows when you spread rumors about people,
nice.
And it becomes, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk size.
I like
and
the
so
story.
That's what I'm picturing when I read about this noxious weed.
I was picturing Day of the Triffids, a science fiction classic where, you know, space seeds land and the plants seem really nice and everybody's fine with them until they get up and walk and sting you, turn the earth blind, and then eat us as prey.
Lovely.
That's what I was thinking. Yours is probably nicer and much more of a family pride.
So much apocalyptic talk today.
Exactly. Speaking of which, U.S. women's soccer team has been basically the talk of the town and talk of the nation, certainly the talk of politics over the course of the last month. But now people are looking back to Jalene Hinkle, the 26-year-old star for the North Carolina Courage professional team, who's been called the top left defender in the U.S. game. She had said she has been identified as one of the top players, but she was excluded from the World Cup. Now, Dory did a talk about this about a year ago because she was excluded, they think, because of her strong Christian faith. She had refused to wear the so-called pride jersey because she said it conflicted with her Christian faith. And, of course, the super politically correct, you must conform with me or I will label you as a hater crowd, said that her refusal was akin to being a hater, which I always find ridiculous and absurd. I mean, just because someone disagrees with you, with your sexuality, with your habits, with your politics, with your religion, whatever it is, it doesn't make them a hater. But it's highly suspected that she's been left out of these major teams because of her religious beliefs, which is also, you know, illegal. And before you say, no, I mean, surely people wouldn't be that sensitive and freak out in that way. Well, think about what's happening at the University of British Columbia, for example, where the entire university was booted out of the Pride Parade.
Jen Smith is known to deliver talks that qualify under hate speech and anti-trans rhetoric. There was a lot of outpouring of expression from the queer and trans community on campus, faculty, students, and staff, who asked for the talk not to happen, and it still went ahead. Consult the community, change the policy to protect the most marginalized people from hate speech on campus.
You know, when you've got a parade and a whole month named after you, you're not that marginalized anymore. You can say you're previously marginalized, but it's tough to say you're marginalized now. The idea that you'd have to go and get permission from one group who's bound to disagree with the speaker for the speaker to speak, it doesn't make sense either. And so they excluded the entire university just for allowing the speech, even though the university has a number of other LGBTQ groups and clubs on the community. They excluded the entire community. Some people, some students were able to march, but they weren't able to march under the university banner because they'd committed the great sin of allowing someone to speak who didn't meet this other organization's stamp of approval, which by any measure is about chilling the speech. In fact, the entire attitude about this kind of thing is increasingly reminiscent of one of the more infamous Seinfeld episodes in which Kramer wanted to march in the AIDS awareness parade but refused to wear the ribbon.
Hey, where's your ribbon?
Well, I don't wear the
ribbon. You don't wear the ribbon? Aren't you against AIDS?
Yeah, I'm against AIDS. I mean, I'm walking on it. Just don't wear the ribbon.
Who do you think you are?
Put the ribbon on.
Hey, Cedric, Bob, this guy won't wear a ribbon.
Who? Who doesn't want to wear the ribbon? So, what's it going to be? Are you going to wear the ribbon?
No, never.
But I'm wearing the ribbon. He's wearing the ribbon. We are all wearing the ribbon. So why aren't you going to wear the ribbon?
This is America. I don't have to wear anything I don't want to wear.
What are we going to do with him?
I guess we're just going to have to teach him to wear the ribbon.
I thought it was one of the funnier episodes, commentary on political correctness and this whole idea of you're so super tolerant that you're absolutely intolerant of anybody else. And now, you know, fiction is looking tamer than real life these days, which is kind of sad and pathetic. The View is out. The women of The View join forces to blast Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for daring to call Nancy Pelosi racist.
Ladies. It's like it's disheartening. It's like the enemy is the guy tweeting in his toilet. That's who the enemy is, not each other. Stop it. That makes me sad. I mean, the Democrats, we have to get rid of this guy, and this type of infighting is not helping. And I don't know about going to the to race right away. It's like, really, that's where you go right away? I thought that was a bit much, frankly. What do you say to that?
Well, I have a problem with how all these young women started out when they were accusing, you know, older Democrats like myself of not getting what needed to be done in the country, and started saying, you know, you haven't done this. And I do believe on the show, I said, well, so are you saying that the guys that, you know, are in now didn't march across the Pettus Bridge? That wasn't important enough. And so for me, when you start out telling people that they don't know what they're doing and get out of the way, you know, it's annoying to people. So I don't think this had to do with color. I think this is more, I don't know, BS, because really Nancy Pelosi and Di Feinstein have both been there a zillion years by themselves fighting this cause.
Let me pause there, because one of the amusing things about this is a similar kind of conversation took place in the Tea Party, where they said, hey, look, you know, these other rhinos over there, Republicans in name only, you know, they've been around, they haven't done anything, you know, and we're taking over. And oftentimes they're talking about people who had actually been in the trenches, you know, fighting for what their values were. And then, you know, doing the campaign work, doing the hard work of governing, doing the hard work of being in the minority and trying to attain the majority. And so, you know, there's that similar kind of thing. Now, in this case, the race card enters something else entirely. But note what they do, which I thought was interesting, is for both of the leftists on The View, they start with not what did she say. Like, they're not examining the accusations of AOC. They're just saying, you shouldn't fight with each other. Let's exclude our side from this charge. Now, I thought the charge was bogus. Don't get me wrong. I thought AOC was just lobbing this out. But they're not examining that part. They're just basically saying, hey, I agree with Nancy Pelosi. I think Trump's got to be gone. Therefore, you shouldn't be talking this way, which isn't really how it's supposed to work. You're supposed to look for the truth and figure out, is there merit to what she is saying? Take a look at the actual accusation and then tackle it that way. And then say, you know, so this kind of bogus charge against your own side's wrong. And by the way, the bogus charge against anybody's side should be wrong.
Of making life better.
So this is why it hurts.
You have to. Well, yeah, you know, I don't know what happens to people, but please remember that the people who are here now, all you young people, you're on the shoulders of a whole bunch of people who came before you. And you have to stop discounting that. I know everybody has to have young people come in. That's the way of the world. But you can't start by saying that they didn't do their job, so get out of the way so you can do it.
So again, the argument wasn't over the initial stuff, which was, hey, the old guard is—they're too enmeshed in their own stuff. They've basically become satisfied with where they are and what they want to do. That wasn't the debate. That wasn't the accusation. The accusation was Nancy Pelosi is specifically targeting women of color, and so you have to take a look at that. But they've switched the topic on that. Now, Meghan McCain said, it's Pelosi who delivered the midterms. That's what I would say to these four women. It was her leadership. She's 79 years old. You know, on that score, I would say more than anything else, I don't think it was Nancy Pelosi's dynamic and clever political leadership or some kind of new vision she came up with in terms of an agenda for the Democrats, because it really, the midterm, and I think whether you're conservative or liberal, you would probably agree with me on this, the midterm became primarily and overwhelmingly about whether or not you were approving of Trump. I mean, that even the ads were focused on this is a vote for or against. And so it was tough for other candidates to be able to argue, hey, well, about these positions, I'm on your side, because everything was focused on the guy at the head of the food chain, so to speak. So, you know, you can, I think it's giving Pelosi a little too much credit in that circumstance. And again, it doesn't address what the actual accusation was, which was, you know, AOC claiming that Nancy Pelosi was dismissing her because she was a woman of color and because other women were women of color. And we've seen something similar from a state senator here in Washington State, who we'll get to here a bit later on in the program. In the meantime, quick update on the controversy in the election regarding the Mississippi state representative who's a candidate for the Republican nomination for governor. Larison Campbell, the reporter for Mississippi Today, and Robert Foster, the first-term Republican Mississippi state representative, are still duking it out because Foster is the guy who said, I can't let this woman be embedded in my campaign and follow me around. She can follow me around, but she can't be alone with me in my pickup truck as I drive around campaigning, because to be alone would be breaking the pledge I made to my wife, which was I'd never be alone with another woman in this political world. And it's the Billy Graham rule of not giving the appearance of impropriety at any stage. So she's been very upset, saying it's bogus. Yesterday I was explaining, I mean, I think that this goes a little too far, this assumption that, you know, it's one thing to say, well, I don't really want to bring a lady alone into my hotel room for an hour interview because I feel like that might create an appearance of impropriety. This seems to go a bit much in that direction. But again, this is if this guy and his wife, this is their preference, this is the way they want to roll, you know, it just doesn't matter to me. I feel like this is one of those much ado stories because he's a first-term state rep. Who hasn't even finished a term, and now he's running for governor, and he's trying to leapfrog over a bunch of other people. He doesn't have a whole lot of support, and now he's got round-the-clock attention based on this. And the reporter says, look, this is part of the good old boys game. Local reporting's traditionally been a men's field, too, and I think a lot of people see a woman in that space they can't quite process. That's clearly what's happened here. And she says basically for a man, for people to see a woman in alone with a man and to assume that there's sex involved, that just shows that there's the objectification of women. But I would also submit that if you use her logic, it's also condemning of men, right? Because the assumption is, well, a man can't possibly be dealing with a woman without sex being involved. So it's sexist on both ends, and it just becomes, instead of using the label sexist, it just becomes absurd. However, again, if let's say this fellow was a different religion, and let's say he was Muslim, for example, or and he didn't want, or a Muslim woman, for example, and said, hey, look, my religious beliefs dictate that I not be alone. Would we have the same attitude toward him, or would we just say, hey, respect that guy's religious beliefs and let's roll with it? My guess is most people would say, no, let's just respect that this guy's got a different point of view, or this woman has a different point of view, let's just move along. But, you know, this guy's a Southern Christian fella who's got this point of view, and it seems to be a national obsession amongst the political news junkies. And I would just be curious, if you looked at the two side by side, would they be treated the same? And I don't think they would. That said, I'm wondering at what point does whatever publication that she works for, you know, at what point do you justify having wall-to-wall coverage anyway of one candidate for governor who is, you know, polling like Jay Inslee is in the presidential election? You know, I mean, how many news outlets on a national scale are saying we got to get somebody embedded with Inslee at all times? You know, it might be the kind of thing where you'd wait a while. Although now the update is this candidate, as I predicted yesterday, is actually running and raising money based on the fact that there's so much coverage of this refusal that he has, saying that the liberal media won't leave him alone and that they're trying to pressure him into breaking this vow and that he won't be bullied by them. Please give me money.
It was all a plot.
Yeah, it all works.
All a plot to raise his profile.
Yeah, maybe she's actually his best campaign supporter right now. She is, like, as a fundraising tool, he's now had millions of dollars worth of advertising nationwide that he would not otherwise have received. So maybe his wife is actually the mastermind here. She's like, you know what? You want attention? I'll tell you how to do it. Here it is. Good job. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. On the line with us is Bill Steele. He's with the Pacific Northwest Seismology Network, here to talk to us about the earthquake that occurred in Washington State and related issues. Bill, thanks so much for making the time.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Now, a lot of people, they hear about the earthquakes that occurred in Los Angeles, the cluster of earthquakes, about 30 near Mount Hood, and then we've got our own earthquake here, and it starts to feel like we're heading toward the end times with earthquakes happening everywhere. What's wrong with that point of view?
Well, I mean, all of those areas are seismically active regions. Mount Hood has some unique problems. We do have volcanoes that, luckily, those seem to be tectonic earthquakes, and so we're not looking at volcanic unrest here. But it is a source of earthquake swarms periodically. The L.A. area, of course, that eastern shear zone is very stressed and has produced big earthquakes in the past and will in the future. But it's a very different tectonic setting than us up here. So, yes, we're noticing these earthquakes, and yes, we've had some significant events occur in a lot of different areas over the past week, but I don't think we need to, they're not necessarily connected, or they aren't connected.
What's the difference between our earthquake here and the ones that occurred in Los Angeles, for example?
Well, our earthquake was much deeper. It was a 23 kilometers depth instead of around 8 kilometers depth in L.A. Area. Secondly, it's a whole different fault system and driven by different plate tectonics up here than is down in the L.A. area. And there they had a magnitude 6.4 and a 7.1. So they got much bigger earthquakes that had stronger and longer duration shaking. Now, luckily for them, it was mostly in the Mojave Desert, and there was only small cities nearby. If that kind of earthquake occurred on the South Whidbey Island Fault, for example, near Everett or Monroe, or on the Seattle Fault, it would be a much, much worse case scenario.
In what way?
We would have billions of dollars worth of damage in disrupted transportation systems, utilities out. It would be the big one for us.
When people talk about the big one here, I've read reports where they say that anything west of I-5 in the Seattle area would end up, the ground would liquefy. What would that actually mean? Does that mean everything sinks like, you know, a stone in a bathtub? Or how does that actually work?
Yeah, no, that was quite an exaggeration. There are low-lying areas where you have sandy soil and you've got a high water table. When the ground shakes, the sand wants to compress like cereal in a box you pick up at the store that seems half full. It was filled to the brim, but it shook in transit and it kind of compacted. Well, when you've got water in between those grains of sand and you try to compact it, it won't reduce in volume. What happens is the pressure, the water pressure, shoots up. And when it gets high enough, the ground behaves like a viscous liquid as opposed to a solid. So you have areas and roadways, say, near Capitol Lake in Olympia, near Elliott Bay, near the Duwamish, that could migrate out toward the water, and the soil just kind of moves. You have, can have buildings settle differentially, so they might tip over partway. There are famous examples from Japan where whole apartment complexes fell over just because one side sunk and the other side didn't, until the whole apartment building just tipped over completely intact but on its side.
So it doesn't mean that if you're standing outside, suddenly you're swimming in a dirt pool, basically.
Well, it doesn't mean that you're going to be sucked down in a vortex or something into the earth, but there are sand and water volcanoes that will erupt and squirt columns of water carrying sand 6-7 feet in the air, and that can flood the whole region. So the Puyallup Valley was flooded during the 1965 and 49 earthquakes, where there was water everywhere in the low-lying areas. So it can result in localized flooding, but not the kind of flooding that is going to carry you off or suck you down into the ground.
Was there anything about this particular earthquake that that concerned you?
Well, I mean, I think it's the perfect earthquake because it occurred deep. It was a 4.6, which is really below the threshold we normally start seeing damage. But it shook people well enough that they became really aware that, oh, yeah, here's another area. And, oh, there are a lot of earthquakes there, and they've happened in the past. And they, in 1994, the Duval earthquake, about 12 miles from where this earthquake occurred, produced over $1 million worth of damage at electrical substations and damaged homes. It was a 5.4 or 5.3 rather than a 4.6, so it was a significantly bigger earthquake, but still not that much bigger. So this was kind of a threshold event. It got people's attention without causing damage or injury.
What, just as a reminder, what's the difference between a 4.1 and a 4.2 earthquake?
Every step on the magnitude scale is a release of 32 times the energy of the previous one. And that tends to result in about 10 times the ground motion as expressed in amplitude of shaking. So, for example, a magnitude 5 is 32 times more energetic than a 4. A magnitude 6 is 1,200 times more energetic than a 4. So it's 32 times 32. And then to go to magnitude 7, well, then you have to take that 1,200 times 32, and you get a very big number. And so you can see how these magnitude 4.5 type earthquakes really don't do a lot to reduce the probability of big earthquakes, because right, big earthquakes release so much more energy than these smaller ones that they don't make much of a dent.
It sounds like one of those systems, it reminds me in school when you're learning about the metric system versus our system, and you know, you think divisible by 10, that's so easy. It seems like there should be an easier way of saying, hey, the 4 versus 5, it just sounds like, well,
I'm not worried about a 5. And we could, it's a little easier if you kind of diagram it as kind of a wave.
Yeah.
And you can see that 10 times ground motion, if you put blocks to fill in the space underneath that sinusoidal wave that went up, you'd have 32 blocks to kind of make that 10 times the ground motion. But it is a little complicated and a little difficult to understand. To confuse people more, we have different measurements between the size of the earthquake and the impact of the earthquake. What a lot of folks don't realize is it's the intensity of the earthquake that matters to them where they are. So if you have a magnitude 6 earthquake, but it occurred in Portland, you're not going to worry about it in Seattle.
Right.
But if that earthquake is near you, you're going to have very strong intensity shaking that's going to cause damage, and you are going to worry about that. So magnitude is the energy released by the earthquake. Intensity is how strong did it shake where you are or where anyone else is. So the intensity varies depending on where you are and the local conditions. The magnitude remains the same everywhere.
All right, one final question for you, and this is about the tsunami danger that people talk about from time to time from earthquakes, you know, off our coast or elsewhere. I read a report today, I think, from the SeattlePI.com, where they were talking about tsunami dangers all the way down the Puget Sound. Is that accurate? Because my understanding is that, you know, the tsunami dangers on the coast make sense, but all the way up and down the Puget Sound, is that a possibility?
Yeah, we have multiple tsunami hazards here, frankly. One of the big earthquake offshore, the Cascadia subduction zone, would allow tsunami energy down the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Then it would open up and it would be dissipated somewhat, but we would have very strong currents and water level changes that could bottom out a marina and then flood it again. So, and certainly very, very strong currents. They're modeled currents of like 60 miles an hour or more in certain straits in the Puget Sound area. And that's going to be very difficult to navigate. So it's going to be a bit of a mess. The other source for a problem is a big earthquake on the Seattle Fault in AD 900, about 1,100 years ago. We had a magnitude 7.4 estimated earthquake on the Seattle Fault that lifted the floor of the Puget Sound 21 feet. And that put a 7-meter, 21-foot wave in Elliott Bay that, if it occurred today, would flood the Soto neighborhood and overtop Harbor Island, and that would be a disaster. So now, luckily, those are very rare big earthquakes, but it's something that we really don't want to see again. The third source for tsunamis are big landslides can also occur that will drop a lot of material into deep water, and that can generate a wave which is usually only damaging locally. It's not going to be a Puget Sound-wide problem, but for people that are living, you know, near the shore on the other side of the sound or the strait, they can easily get flooded. So those are the three main reasons we're concerned. Generally speaking, with earthquakes, if you're near the water, you're at a higher danger, because it could be a landslide, it could be a land level change, or something else could generate a wave that could affect you. So you kind of want to move up away from the water if you can.
Well, you've got me convinced. I work in Soto usually, so I need a surfboard. Bill Steele.
with
the Pacific Northwest Seismology Network. Thanks so much for making the time. Great to have you on the Dory Monson Show. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Welcome back to the big show. There's kind of some sad news if you're a fan like me of newspapers and the ability to actually, you know, pick up a paper when you're at a restaurant, just kind of kick back and enjoy it. Starbucks is canceling the sale of newspapers at their venues. New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Gannett papers like USA Today will no longer be in their 8,600 U.S. stores starting in September. Now, they cite changing customer behavior. And at first I thought, well, maybe they're going to stop selling them because so many people at Starbucks, they buy one paper and then everybody else is using it and they're hanging around the store forever. You know, but that can't be it, right? I mean, I never see it seems to me the newspapers sell pretty well there. There's always somebody willing to buy the paper, at least use the paper. And then they're willing to let people camp there all day long with their computers and work there. So I was trying to figure out the why. Is it really that bad that people who are walking into the Starbucks are no longer willing to open up a newspaper? This is part of the sad era, by the way, because I know there's a lot of people on the right side. It's like hashtag fake news, can't stand the newspapers. They're at war with the media. The left side has their own stuff where they're angry at the media if they don't toe exactly the line that they want. You know, the Seattle Times gets flack for that from time to time. But the reality is you need local newspapers. In fact, there was a fascinating column in National Review a while back pointing out that with local newspapers and local journalism, the collapse of that local journalism in places that lost their local newspaper, there was less accountability in government, and the overall efficiency of tax dollars went down because people were no longer afraid of being called to task by the local newspaper. And so I find this story particularly sad. And maybe it's just me. I'm at that age where, you know, people close to my age, they like to just read it online and just grab their tablet or whatever and do it that way. And then people older than me tend to entirely just go print all the time. I'm more of a mix. You know, I mean, in my school and back in high school, we were the first class that had computer science classes, you know, but not everybody took it. So it was just, I'm right at that cusp. But I find myself sad because I like to actually lift up the printed paper, kick back, read it while I'm with my cup of coffee or with my meal, whatever it is I want. And if Starbucks is stopping, you can bet that other restaurants are not far behind. And it makes you wonder, what will you be reading and how will you be reading it? And you know, when we're all together and reading the same paper, there's a cultural component to that as well. Sad times. David Bowes and Fedori Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM.